Our next speaker is Susan Thorpe. Susan is a professor of finance and superannuation at UTS. But Susan focuses, I think, less on the money side and more on the behavioural side of retirement. And I guess particularly looking at why don't people do what they're supposed to do or what we think they ought to do. So we're going to dig down into the behavioural aspects of retirees and how some of the previous two speakers' external environment might actually be reflected and how people behave and how we'd like them to behave. So please give Susan Thorpe a very warm welcome.
I have some third-year finance and economics students who probably wish that I focused more on behavioural aspects of the retirement problem and a little bit less on the theory. So this group of third-year students are currently working on the problem of how to optimally save and invest for retirement. And they work with a model that's relatively straightforward but still complicated enough when you have to actually try and find an optimal solution to the problem. And it's interesting to think with them about the key pieces of information that you need to know if you're going to think about how to manage your wealth in retirement. Now, we've heard so far from Carol, fascinating material at the macroeconomic and global level. Deborah's spoken to us about the types of issues that are confronting us at the perhaps at the industry or economy-wide level when we think about the retirement space. I'm going to drill down now to very much the individual level and not the individual expert such as is making up the audience here, but the ordinary individual, the unsophisticated investor who's reaching retirement at the end of a reasonably long, we hope, accumulation in a defined contribution scheme and for the first time in their life confronts the difficult problem of managing a lump sum of wealth over an uncertain length of time. So when we think about this in our third year undergraduate finance class, we list a bunch of information that we need to know in order to solve this problem in a rigorous way. Now these include things like time issues. At what time will you retire? How long can you expect to live? What rates of return can you expect to achieve in the various types of securities that might be available to for you to invest in? What's the volatility of those rates of return? How much wealth will you have to manage? What size accumulation will you be working with? What are your preferences about risk and return? What are your intentions in terms of patience or impatience? And finally, what sorts of products are available to you in the post-retirement market that might help you manage this particular problem? So when we think about that in the classroom, it's actually a reasonable list for thinking about what ordinary people need to know when they confront this problem at their own retirement age, and when they're thinking about what to do for the next 30 or so years in which they have to manage this unfamiliarly large lump sum of wealth in an environment where they're not participating in the labour market anymore. Well, one of the things, so when we think about this particular problem, we're thinking in terms of this set of information. And I'm going to talk about how ordinary Australian consumers understand these items and what we know about what they know about these and how this affects the way they think about managing their wealth in retirement. So first of all, as I said, you'd like to know what income stream products are available to you. There are a bunch of risks you have to think about, investment risks, mortality risk, the risk associated with your working life and the uncertainties associated with that, and just how much wealth you might need and how you interpret that wealth in terms of income adequacy. So on the first question, a few years ago we did a survey that confronted middle-aged Australians, people in the age range 50 to 75 years, almost 1,000 people we surveyed, and we asked them lots of questions, but among those that we asked was a series of questions relating to how well they understood some basic retirement income products. And you can see the results here on this table in relation to two of the products we surveyed on, that's a lifetime annuity and an allocated pension. Now those of you who are familiar with the market will know that about half of the funds that move into retirement income streams, half of the funds that reach retirement move into allocated pension products. A much smaller percentage almost vanishingly small at certain points in time, move into lifetime annuity products. One of the reasons that we suspect that this is the case is that very few people have heard of the products and understand their main features. So of those we surveyed, and remember that these are middle-aged people approaching retirement and some of them already retired, around a third had heard of the idea of a lifetime annuity. And of those, only 22% understood that it offered a guaranteed income stream for the remainder of your life, and only 8% understood the guarantees. So 22% understood that it lasted a lifetime, and around 8% knew that the income level was quite safe. This is a very, very poorly understood product. Perhaps unsurprisingly because the market's so small, but also because of the history that we are working with in Australia. When it came to allocated pensions, about the same proportion of our sample had heard of these as typically takes these products up, about 48%. But of those, only a quarter knew about the minimum drawdown regulations that apply to allocated pension income streams, and only 20% knew of one of the most favourable features of an allocated pension, which is that it offers you liquidity. You can withdraw your capital from it. So the understanding that people need to make good decisions in terms of the products is particularly low. The picture doesn't get a lot better when we start asking questions more generally about the superannuation system, about the age pension, and about market risk in general. So if you look at the table here, this is just a selection of some other questions that we've surveyed people on around the same period of time. And you can see, if you look along the first row there, which asks about the favourable tax treatment of superannuation, that around 40% of people are either unsure or wrong about the favourable tax treatment of superannuation. The perhaps more alarming answer is in the next row, which asks people if they understand the content of a balanced superannuation investment option. Now, recall that somewhere in the region of 70 to 80% of superannuation funds are invested in this type of investment option. And notice here that fewer than 40% of people could answer this question correctly, and the majority of them were unsure about the content of a balanced superannuation investment option, in particular thinking that there's likely to be a much higher proportion of safe assets in this type of investment than actually occurs. So these are very poorly understood, even though the majority of people are participating in this type of investment option, and if they move into the allocated pension phase are likely to continue to do so. Now, one could argue that one of the beauties of a mandatory system that offers defaults is that people don't have to understand this type of product, and to a certain extent that's true. However, emerging research and anecdotes suggest that when people don't understand defaults well, dissatisfaction is likely to arise. So one of the risks that's being confronted by the superannuation industry in Australia and the financial services sector in general is that reliance of default may have long-term effects on people's attitudes, trust, and willingness to participate in the financial sector that have been perhaps unanticipated in the course of the last couple of decades. If you look at the next couple of questions, you'll see that there's considerable uncertainty surrounding the age pension, and that perhaps would the proportions answering don't know to those sorts of questions would probably be larger if I did that survey today than when I did it about a year ago. And when it comes to understanding the minimum age at which you can access your superannuation, it's a 50-50 bet as to whether people will know the answer to that question or not. So there's concerns about the time horizons. There's also concerns about people's understanding of retirement. So if you look on this graph along the bottom, you can see the age groups of the people that we were asking this question of. And on the vertical axis, you can see the proportion of people who are answering either that they regard retirement as a distant event or a non-distant event. So the people on the red line regard retirement as distant. The people on the blue line regard it as not so distant. And you can see that there's a crossing point in the middle in around the mid-40s when the number of people who regard it as distant and non-distant are about equal. But the point to the area to look at is on the right-hand side of that graph where we're studying people in their 50s and 60s, a large percentage of which still regard retirement as being a distant prospect. Now, the government might be reinforcing this view at the moment. However, in terms of financial planning, a decade or two decades is not a long period of time. And we would like people to be thinking about that a little earlier. So understanding how close retirement is and how much time they have organised is, again, not terribly well understood. When it comes to survival, we face similar problems. If you look at the two charts up here on this side, you can see the red line is what the government actuary thinks about percentage probability of survival at a particular target age. Target age is along the horizontal axis. And the blue line is the predictions of people that we surveyed, again, in middle age. On the left-hand side graph, you can see along the blue line the subjective survival forecasts of people, males in this case, in their 50s. And on the right-hand side graph, you can see the subjective survival forecasts of males in their 70s at the time that we surveyed them. Interesting thing about this, you can't see this from the graphs, but the overall level of underestimation of survival across both genders was in the region of 6 to 7 years. In total, in terms of underestimation of life expectancy, which is an interesting number because it pops up all over the globe. I've recently been to conferences where similar data from the Netherlands and Germany were presented, very similar mistakes and very similar scales of mistake being made right across the developed world by people approaching retirement. But one of the interesting things you can see here is that younger people are more pessimistic about their survival prospects than older people. And it's interesting that people in the critical planning phase of life in their late 40s and early 50s are likely to be excessively pessimistic about their survival prospects compared with people who actually reach retirement, particularly males in their 70s, who tend to be somewhat more optimistic, in fact, perhaps a little too optimistic about their prospects of surviving to older ages. If I'd put the graphs up for females, they would have looked similar, only women are more pessimistic still than men and less optimistic about their old age survival. So what do we know so far? Well, we know that people don't know a lot about the products that are available to them. Their understanding of the current regulatory environment and the systems are not terribly good. They're unsure about their retirement and they're not even sure whether that's a close or distant prospect. And when it comes to their longevity, they tend to be thinking more pessimistically than they need to in terms of their planning phase. Now, the last aspect of this that I'd like to speak to, and I'm going to speak to this for a little bit longer, relates to how people perceive the adequacy of their financial accumulation towards retirement. Now, when we ask people about this, about 48% of the middle-aged folk that we sample in the 50 to 65-year age group have tried to work out how much money they might need for their retirement. We don't try and find out how well they've done the sums. We're just asking them, have you actually tried to work this out? That's slightly fewer than half. But at the same time, they're not optimistic in general about what retirement's going to look like. So about 50% of those that we survey expect their income to go down somewhat or a lot during retirement. So it's possible that one of the reasons people don't want to think about this is they're worried about the possible outcome. Now, the question that I want to finish off with is whether people would actually know what adequacy looked like, even if they did accurately figure out how much they had and what that was likely to be by the time they reach retirement. There's been some fascinating work done recently by a team of people who study financial decision making in the United States, addressing this question of how people understand large sums of wealth. Now, this is crucial in Australia because for the past 20 years, the superannuation industry has been describing people's accumulations in terms of account balances, understandably, and rates of returns on account balances. And there's been very little discussion about how those account balances translate into streams of income during the course of retirement. Now, if you're a funds manager, lump sums of wealth are interpretable and rates of return and volatilities have meaning, but for ordinary individuals, the numeraire of life is monthly incomes because we most of us exist in a world of salaries and regular income streams, and that's the way we think about budgeting and about the future. So there's some interesting research that's being done on how people can how people translate between lump sums and monthly income streams. And the question is, do retirement lump sums seem larger than their monthly income equivalents? And how does this change when as the wealth amount changes? So is this worse when the wealth amounts are lower or higher? And how does it affect people? And when they think about this, what does it do for their savings? How do they respond in terms of their savings strategy? Now this graph was collected by a colleague of mine, Dan Goldstein, and his co-authors in the United States in a very recently published paper where they surveyed about 900 middle-aged retirees in the United States. Now their environment's not dissimilar to ours. A lot of them are members of 401k plans. Now along the horizontal axis here you can see lump sum amounts, and these are reasonably meaningful for the superannuation sector in Australia. Retirees, male retirees in our system at the moment are retiring with accumulations around $200,000 on average. And you can see that the scale moves up towards $2 million on the right-hand side. On the vertical axis, you can see how individuals in this survey rated the perceived adequacy of this amount of money in two different experimental treatments. One that when they were simply showed the lump sum value of the wealth, $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, how adequate do you think this will be on a scale of 0 to 6? The dotted line shows you people's perceptions of adequacy when those lump sums were translated into an annuity stream based on current market conditions in the United States. So if I took my $200,000 and I went to the market and I turned it into an annuity stream, what would that buy me in terms of monthly income? The perceived adequacy of those monthly incomes is shown on the dotted line. Two very interesting things here. First of all, at the left-hand side of the horizontal axis, when we're looking at amounts in the $100,000 to $200,000 range, it's very clear that people perceive lump sums to be significantly more adequate than the equivalent monthly income stream that those lump sums would buy them. When they become very relatively wealthy in the $2 million area of the graph, you can see that the perceptions reverse. People actually have trouble understanding very large lump sums of wealth also in terms of the relative adequacy that they produce. So what we see here is that people in the normal range of accumulations are generally more sensitive to monthly amounts than lump sums, and your typical Australian superannuant is going to perceive the adequacy of their $200,000 lump sum as being much higher than the monthly income stream that it might guarantee. Now this translates also into people's savings intention. So you can see on this graph here, when people were asked about their plans to save more, given the same information, either they were showed a $100,000, $200,000 lump sum or the monthly income equivalent, you can see that their intentions to save more for retirement was much higher when they saw the monthly income equivalent than when they saw the lump sum equivalent at the lower end of accumulation, and didn't switch until we were right at the top towards the $2 million amount. Now, this is one of these instances where six of one is not equal to half a dozen of the other. When it comes to talking to consumers about wealth, the way that we frame that discussion is crucial to the way that people think about the outcomes. And as I said before, it's convenient and natural and understandable that we have over the past couple of decades spoken to people in terms of account balances, rates of return and terminal wealth values. My point here is that most of us don't get it. And if we want people to really think about how their retirement's going to look and how they need to prepare for it, we need to change the framing towards the numeraire that most people understand, which is much more to do with monthly income provision than it is to do with accumulations of lump sums. So I just want to finish off by encouraging you in whatever your role in the financial services industry, and I think actuaries have got so much to bring to this discussion, because understanding income streams, understanding longevity risk pooling, and generally speaking about long horizon problems is something that actuaries are well trained to do. And I think we need to engage with people. We need to inform them with crucial information where possible. We need to talk more about income streams and less about wealth accumulation. And we need to really try more try with a lot more energy to help people understand what their options are.